Welcome to Quimper UU Fellowship. We hope you enjoy this recording from our Christmas Eve service. You will hear Reverend Lohr read the Christmas story and then present remarks entitled The Christmas Gift. Following that, you will hear Reverend Bodie's remarks, The Still Point of the Turning World. And finally, Franz Schubert's Ave Maria, performed by Victoria Poling on violin and Akui Goldstein on piano. Thanks for listening.
I'm about to read the oldest and most well-known description of the birth of Jesus. It comes from the second chapter of the Gospel of Luke. It's important to note that Jesus' birth happened during a time when the most common way of conveying stories was to do so verbally. Thus, it was a full 70 years or so before anyone wrote down the details, and by then a few embellishments were undoubtedly included. Still, it is a story worthy of our thoughtful, heartfelt consideration. So, if you will, please try to imagine yourself now going back to that time and hearing this story for the very first time. In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census would be taken of the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Cyrenius was governor of Syria, and everyone went to their own town to register. So Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth, into the city of David in Bethlehem, because he belonged to the house and line of David. He went there to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him and expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in swaddling clothing and placed him in a manger because there was no room at the inn. And there were in the same country shepherds living out in the fields nearby, keeping watch over their flocks at night. An angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were terrified. But the angel said to them, "Do not be afraid. I bring you good news that will cause great joy for all the people. Today in the town of David, a Savior has been born to you. He is the Messiah, the Lord. This will be a sign to you. You will find a baby wrapped in swaddling clothing and lying in a manger." Suddenly, a great company of the heavenly hosts appeared with the angel, praising God and saying, "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth goodwill and peace to all." When the angels had left them and gone back into heaven, the shepherds said to one another, "Let's go to Bethlehem and see this thing that has happened, which the Lord hath told us about." And so they hurried off and found Mary and Joseph and the baby who was lying in the manger. When they had seen him, they spread the word concerning what had been told them about this child. And all who heard it were amazed at what the shepherds said to them. But Mary treasured up all these things and pondered them in her heart. The shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all the things they had seen and heard, which were just as they had been told. So ends the reading.
Thank you.
angels appearing in the sky, shepherds setting aside their daily routine to go and see a newborn baby, a star that shines with exceptional brightness and moves in the sky, wise men who follow it and bring gifts to a child born in a manger. It is such a rich and wondrous story. Perhaps this is why each year on this night we join with seekers of ages past to retell the Christmas story. It is a story perhaps intentionally hard for us to believe, but one that nonetheless reveals to us an undeniable truth and miracle, that the birth of an infant can forever change the world. But there is another core to the Christmas story that is just as valuable, and it's the idea and the experience of the gift given. The entire Christmas story is, in fact, a story of gifts given. Mary gives herself as a vessel through which one of the greatest prophets the world has ever known is born. Joseph gives himself as a caretaker and protector of Mary in spite of the extreme hardships they face and in spite of the confusing circumstances surrounding the pregnancy. The wise men, too, give gifts, of course, gifts of great value to mark the birth of a newborn child of God. In return, Jesus, too, gives us gifts, the gifts of hope, of rebirth, of mystery and miracle, and most importantly, a gift of his revolutionary message of love. This love of which I speak is a love so great and far-reaching that it still comforts the hearts of ill and broken-hearted people all over the world today. A love so transformative that even during the darkest time of the year and the darkest hours of our lives, we find new perspectives, new courage, and new hope. A love so powerful that it inspires people to pause from their regular routine to consider the needs of those who hunger, those lacking housing, and those who are sick and in need of healing. And a love so radical that it calls us to rebuild the nations and bring peace among people, even when we're afraid, even when we're facing great odds, even when peace seems like nothing more than a pipe dream. Inspired then by Jesus' teachings on love, we have learned one of life's most profound lessons, that to give is really to receive, that by giving something that is precious as an act of devotion to the greater good, we experience an extraordinary personal breakthrough. This is because such giving involves the surrender of the self. And in that emptying, in that letting go and giving away, love is now able to enter into us and transform us in whole new ways. And that, my friends, is a decidedly deeper concept of giving than anything you'll see on the holiday commercials. Christmas, then, becomes our annual invitation to journey to our inner selves, where love lives, and wherever love lives, perspectives, courage, and life can be born anew. It is the promise spoken by Isaiah when he said, "The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light, for unto us a child is born." And so it is again this night, a great light shines once again, and new possibilities are born anew for us and for all people. Birth, rebirth, and the miraculous transformative power of love. This is the reality, the magic, and the truth that lives on in the Christmas story. And this is the greatest gift we will ever receive on Christmas. So, as we stand together on the cusp of Christmas Day, let us leave here remembering that love is the real reason for this season. May you give it generously in the coming days, and in so doing, may your lives and our world be blessed and transformed. Amen.
At the beginning of August, I announced that this would be my concluding year as your minister here at Quimper Unitarian. And you know how it is when you say something like that, it shifts some things, whether you will or no. One of the shifts I've found in myself is a tendency to want to try to summarize in this final year. For 40 years, I've been a minister. 10 years about in preparation for that. And so now let me try again to say what I've been trying to say all along. Maybe more clearly, maybe more openly. To confess, for example, that these Christmas Eve services are my favorite services of the year. Why? I love the darkness. I love the candlelight. I like the play of light and dark and shadow. I like the stillness. I like the song. I like the ceremony. These are certainly important parts, but it's not probably the primary thing. But mostly, it's the notion and the experience of symbol, where everything is drawn to a single point. And so it is every year that I've been a minister here in the Sundays leading up to Christmas Eve, I say to the children, look, we're putting up banners on the chancel wall, and look, we're lighting matching candles in our candelabra. Christmas is coming, I say to them. Christmas is coming. Can you feel it? The animals are here. They can feel it. Can you feel it? I tell them that this night, this Christmas Eve night, is the most special night of the whole year. I encourage our children to believe that everything points to and leads away from this one holy night, that this night is the emotional and spiritual hinge of the year. And even as I do this, I know there's a certain danger here, which is the danger of literalism, of believing that this might somehow actually literally be different than all other nights, and that the birth of the child of Bethlehem on this night is actually literally different than the birth of all other children. I grant this danger of literalism, but I take the risk because I believe that the risk on the other side is even greater, namely, the risk that one might come to believe that human life is lived on the horizontal plane only, that it's only about physical survival, that it's only about buying and selling and winning and losing. Joseph Campbell, my primary teacher on the nature and value of symbol, gives an account in his interviews with Bill Moyers of something that he had witnessed in India. It was simply a red ring being drawn around a stone. Why would you draw a red ring around a stone? Well, drawing such a ring around a stone, you make a symbol of it. You pull it out of its everyday, objective, useful context, and you frame it. And now you regard it, not in its horizontal dimension, but now you regard it in its vertical dimension, so that it is no longer object to you, it is subject, and you are subject to it because it represents the miraculous power and presence of being itself. You're witnessing that in that single piece of reality, and so you bow before it. It is holy. Well, so too, our culture has drawn a ring around this evening, this Christmas Eve. How long it will last, I don't know. But each year, I try to refresh that ring around Christmas Eve for our children as well as for the child in us. There are four aspects that I briefly want to talk about in this symbol of Christmas, and I've spoken to them in the Christmas Eve with you before. I've spoken of them at various times. And first, Christmas Eve is a symbol, as I have been saying, of the still point in the midst of time. The still point in the midst of time. Here's what T.S. Eliot says. At the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards, at the still point, there the dance is, but neither arrest nor movement. And do not call it fixity where past and future are gathered, neither movement from nor towards, neither ascent nor decline. Except for the point, the still point, there would be no dance, and there is only the dance. Now that still point of the turning world is everywhere. Wherever you stop, wherever you dive in, whatever you draw a ring around, there you may find the still point. And there, if you pay attention, you will also find the dance. So Christmas Eve, where the star stops, is a reminder to us of the still point in time, the vertical dimension, the depth dimension, the dancing miracle of being, the divine suchness of things, as the Buddhists put it, and so wake up. Secondly, Christmas Eve is, of course, a symbol of the birth of the divine child. What child is this? Here's what I've come to. That divine and holy child there in the manger, surrounded by animals, protected and adored by parents, praised by angels, discovered by shepherds, worshipped by wise men, and threatened by a jealous king. That divine child upon whom that light shines represents our own innermost and authentic self, our essential self, the potential self that we are striving to become. This, I believe, is what is felt and honored in that divine and miraculous birth. It is a picture of our own divine birth, the birth of our spirit. Michael Mead speaks about our genius. That's it. This divine birth represents as well, of course, and this is particularly for parents, the divine birth and potentiality of each newborn child. I don't know if you've had the experience in looking into the eyes of a newborn child. They are a window. Those eyes are a window into the eternally creative, forward-pushing urge. that is at the foundation of all being. Through the course of a year and through the course of a lifetime, we may grow weary. The world may at times or often get worn and shorn of its beauty and value for us. And so we need to be reminded. And so each year, at Christmas, the divine child needs to be born again so that we may be born again into the divinity and holiness of our own lives, to be recalled to our better selves. A third aspect of the symbol of Christmas has to do not only with being recalled to the potential of our own better selves, but also to the potential of a better world, a world that bends towards justice, equity, peace, and loving kindness. Christmas, and particularly Christmas Eve, has to do with this elusive human dream. Dreams, we know, exist at a different level of being than daytime reality. We know that dreams are fragile parts of reality that tend to dissipate upon waking when we are required to take up the more complicated tasks of everyday living, when we attempt to shape the dream imagination into concrete reality. But let us, on Christmas Eve, try to stay in this dream world for a little while. Let us not wake up too soon. Let no harsh word, no flare of anger, no hint of human violence, no sarcastic or cynical remark break in upon this spell. Let us, as poet Lucile Anderson puts it, let us sigh softly, lest we break the bauble that is Christmas. Within its tender, iridescent walls, unpierced by fury, prejudice, or scorn, bells peal, eyes shine, and children laugh, while song escorts gold-threaded hours into the star-sprayed night. What a beautiful, tender dream. And I think when I hear that of my dear departed mother and of the bauble of Christmas that she tried to create for her family on Christmas Eve around the Christmas tree, I think of you now, dear mother, on this evening. And I thank you for the sacred, dreamlike space that you arranged for us. Finally, Christmas and Christmas Eve represents not only this fragile world of human connectedness and compassion, it also represents the real possibility of redemption. Perhaps you have heard somewhere that miracles are permitted at Christmas. That Christmas and Christmas Eve is a time when even the most damaged and injured hearts might undergo repair. Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone, Scrooge. A squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner, hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire, secret and self-contained and solitary as an oyster, he carried his own low temperature about him always. He iced his office in the dog days and didn't thaw it 1 degree at Christmas. Nobody ever stopped him in the street to say with gladsome looks, "My dear Scrooge, how are you? When will you come to see me?" No beggars implored him to bestow a trifle. No children asked him what it was o'clock. No man or woman ever once in all his life inquired the way to such and such place of Scrooge. Even the blind men's dogs appeared to know him, and when they saw him coming on, would tug their owners into the doorways and up courtyards. But what did Scrooge care? It was the very thing he liked. To edge his way along the crowded paths of life, warning all human sympathy to keep its distance. But was there perhaps a hidden, generous, even humorous Scrooge beneath that roughened, toughened exterior? In 1843, Charles Dickinson went to work to find out. And what he discovered continues to reverberate around the world as one of the essential meanings of Christmas. And we all know the story of the visitation to Scrooge by the three ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future, which finally brings Scrooge to his knees, breaks through that mask of stinginess and shrewdness that he had worn throughout his adult life. What Charles Dickens found beneath that thick persona were wondrous treasures of inner gold, including what was a great surprise to both Dickens and to his character Ebenezer Scrooge, namely Scrooge's capacity for hearty laughter. When Scrooge's heart was blasted open, out poured this abundance of laughter. He could not stop laughing. Says Dickens, really, for a man who had been out of practice for so many years, it was a splendid laugh, a most illustrious laugh, the father of a long, long line of brilliant laughs. Thus, Ebenezer Scrooge becomes an embodiment of the Christmas spirit, which is the awareness of hidden gold and the possibility of real redemption.